he's gonna hang on to them oars, you gotta start putting your back into it, baby. If he's gonna hang on to them oars, you're gonna have to start putting your back into it, baby. Now, I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. You've been probably wondering what I'm gonna do. And it's a good thing to wonder, because I got things that's gonna do. And I'll tell you what I'm gonna do, friends. I'm gonna give you a chance at long last to earn yourself a fantastic prize. And all you got to do is take hold of these six small plastic balls. Throw them, give them a twist of the wrist there. And each one of them, each one earns a prize. Each one goes into a hole, and each one has a number. And each number adds up to a total that will win you a prize, and everybody wins in this game. So I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm going to make it possible for you to have happiness and success and joy that you have never even understood before and won't ever understand. Because we're laying it on you here. Come on, boys. I know just how you feel. Did I ever tell you about the time I'm standing up there on that stage? 2,000 people sitting down there in the audience all watching. And all of a sudden, without any warning, I suddenly began to have the sneaking suspicion that my fly was open. And there I'm standing there, see, looking down at all them people. And, oh my God, there's only one thing to do. So tonight we'd like to introduce you to life in the confetti factory. They said it's the town where Whoopi was invented.
Hold it there. Dean Shepherd and Eugene Bergman, are you there?
Yes, I certainly am.
Now, when was that from? What was that all about? The Bootlam Shake. Could you hear it?
Yes, I could.
Yeah.
You mean, when was it recorded, et cetera, et cetera? It was recorded in 1926 in a Chicago hotel room, according to the liner notes on the CD remake of it that I have.
But how did it find its way on the Gene Shepherd CD?
Well,
what was your rationale for including that on the Best of Gene Shepherd?
Well, it's one of his favorite pieces of music, and I think it just has this kind of funky sound that he liked to say some of his favorite music had a hairy vitality. And I think he just loved the kind of quirky, as I say, funky, jazzy sound of it. And he would play it from time to time over the years, starting, I know, back in the 50s. So it was just a lot of fun for him. And in the book, I talk about how one of the lines in it is, "I know these words don't mean a thing." And I think he probably got a kick out of the fact that he, who is such a word person, had a song in which the lyrics say the words don't mean a thing.
No.
I find that kind of a strange amusing turn of mind that probably was one of the reasons he liked it.
Now, you mentioned a book, and I guess it's time to remind the audience, or perhaps people have tuned in for the news, which will be not heard until August again, the news rebroadcast, because WBAI is in the first day, the tail end of the first day of our summer emergency fund drive. And on the phone is Eugene Bergman, who has written the first and only book about the radio and other works of Gene Shepherd called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. And that is something we're offering to you tonight as a premium when you join WBAI. And Gene is no stranger to these airwaves. He's been my guest a number of times, as well as other people. He's been heard before. But this book was in the works for, what, 5 or 6 years?
Well, I started gathering notes to write it only a few months after Shepherd died in October 99. And it didn't see the light of day until officially March 28th, 2005. So that's about 5 years from starting to think about it to actually going through all the hassle of finally having one of those two pounders in my hand, a real book to look at.
Well, you actually started, you say you started collecting material for the book in 1999, but you were actually collecting Shepherd material back in the 50s.
Yes, 1956, 57, 58, 59, and 60, I was actually recording some of Shepherd's programs, mainly the ones that he broadcast from just after 9 p.m. on Sunday evenings until 1 a.m. And it's a really quite different style that he used back then, and I kind of get a kick out of it because I think it was sort of the artistic beginnings of what later became his more honed style in his shorter broadcast. But these long ones from 9 to 1 had a very slow-moving improvisational tone, and you never knew where the subject was going. Of course, that's true of the later ones too, but it was a much more of you had to be in this sort of stoked down frame of mind on a Sunday night. You know, you're kind of coming home from wherever you've been, you turn on the radio and there's this guy sort of lazily talking to you, or quite often I was just listening on my radio in the kitchen while my parents were watching TV in the other room.
Now, part of it also the fact that the show was much longer in the early days, and so he could really stretch out more, play, use more music, a lot of jazz.
Yes, and much more contemporary and, shall we say, difficult jazz. Jazz that sometimes I have difficulty following, but the jazz that was current during the 1950s, Stan Getz, for example, and Charles Mingus, and he'd play longer selections from recordings by them. So it was almost, well, it was approaching what you might call a disc jockey show, although you really couldn't call it that because of his extended commentaries, but it certainly did have a lot more musical interludes in the Sunday night shows.
Well, also, yeah, and I guess his performance style was more in the line of improvisational jazz.
Yes,
as well, he's riffing. Who knows? As you say, you don't know where it's going to go. There's a basic framework, and you know he takes off and eventually comes back to the framework.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you call the book The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. What's this enigma business?
Well, when I started thinking about writing the book, I just assumed, well, good old Shep, I'm going to write about all the creative, the artistic aspects of his career in many media. And then I began to find out such things as a lot of what you, most listeners, assumed was truth about his biographical details and other aspects that he was talking about were actually, to a large extent, made up. So there was a certain conflict or contrast between one's assumptions about him and the reality. And, of course, because since he was speaking so much to you in terms of this is reality, this is the truth, this is what I really am all about, these are my thoughts, this is where I come from, there is that feeling that indeed it is true, so that when you find out that parts of it, large parts of it, are not, I think that's somewhat of an enigma. Also, when you find out that in some ways he wasn't always the nice guy that you sort of assumed he was from his broadcast, I think there's a certain enigma aspect to that. And I interviewed a number of people who, although they were friends of his, were rather forthcoming in indicating ways in which he could be not too nice to them and other people around them. And I think there's a certain enigma in that aspect of what he was all about. He was always talking about what a great joy it was to be alive and to be involved in creative life, his own radio work, etc. And yet I found from a number of people that he was very dissatisfied, that he was very unhappy, and in fact sometimes rather bitter about not getting further in the creative fields he was in terms of commercial success or accolades from the masses, etc.
But do you think that set in after he left the radio? Because he was, while doing the daily program on WOR, he also was a noted humor writer, winning several awards for his Playboy stories, which were mostly about his childhood, set in the semi-fictitious Holman, Indiana, actually Hammond, Indiana, which is where he grew up, a suburb of Chicago. But on the radio, he often started his stories with, I was this kid, see? And then, and his listeners just took it all as gospel when he was basically doing radio fiction.
Right. Well, you know, I think he got bit more and more bitter as the years went by, especially after he did leave radio in 77. However, some of the people that I interviewed, such as Herb Saltzman, who was the general manager at WOR from roughly 67 to 77, said that Shepard was bitter at that time. While Saltzman was the general manager, Shepard would come in and as Saltzman said, he would whine. He'd complain. So what you heard on his programs as being this great enthusiasm and pleasure apparently was sometimes a mask for a fair amount of unhappiness on Shepard's part. That's really enigmatic and hard to believe.
Now, he initially came to New York to audition for The Tonight Show. Is that how it came about?
That's the claim. However, it hasn't been really substantiated. You see it quoted, that story told over and over again in magazine articles and so on. I don't know if the story originated with Shepard or where it comes from, but somebody, I'm sorry, I can't remember who it was, but somebody said that they talked to Steve Allen, who supposedly wanted to get Shepard on The Tonight Show, talked to Steve Allen a little while before Alan died and asked him about that, and Alan couldn't remember anything about it.
So another part of the myth and enigma is, yes, Shepard would constantly be telling what may or may not have been true stories about his own background. He claimed at one point that he had appeared as a child actor on the Jack Armstrong show, and I have not been able to confirm that.
Last year at the Old Time Radio Convention, I was pointed towards somebody who apparently is quite an expert on old time radio. And again, I have his name in my notes, but can't remember it offhand. And asked him about it, and he said, "Well, you know, it is possible that Shepard appeared on the Jack Armstrong show a couple of times, but it's not very likely," and he gave me a couple of historical reasons why it wasn't too likely that it actually had happened.
But it could have been, one of the many other, there were a lot of kid shows. It could have been a different show, possibly, or made up out of whole cloth, and we'll never know. There's no way to really know these things. But let's turn a little bit to the musical side of Shepard, because I want to get another cut in here from the CD. And the one I have lined up is about Kopfspielen, one of the many unusual talents of Gene Shepard. Why don't you tell us a little about that?
Well, one of the things I say in the book is, I list some of his many talents, and then I just say, and he was also a master of Kopfspielen. And I'm sure that 9 people out of 10, when they got to that line, thought, well, is he going to say what Kopfspielen is, or isn't he? And, of course, I wait for several chapters before I describe it, and it's to knock out tunes on your head by using your mouth cavity as the sounding area and knocking on top of your head. And several times, we have a number of tapes.
Well, we can't find, unfortunately, of the TV. He did it on what, I've Got a Secret, or To Tell the Truth?
Yeah, everybody is looking for that, and once in a while somebody sees it on the game show network.
Yes, I know someone who claims to have a tape, but they have yet to dig it out of their vast pile of garbage. And he did it. He also,
I would love to see that.
He also did this demonstration for the kids on Wonderama as well. So why don't we listen, and this is one of 3 or 4 of the instruments that Shepard all used that involved various portions of the anatomy above the neck. He was a nose flute master as well as a jew's harp player, and I think we may even hear in this clip some of each. So why don't we turn to Shepard for a few moments, and we'll be right back.
No matter where you slice it, music is a people thing. It is not a machine thing. Now, you can attach machines to people and produce maybe louder, more dynamic music, but ultimately, music is out of people. And so I'm going to show you another type of human-type sound. And again, it's in some ways related to Kopfspielen, but not quite. It's the step between Kopfspielen, which is pure, absolutely pure, and therefore very rare. By Kopfspielen, I mean by pure. It's a pure sound and musical concept produced by the human body itself. And so, since it is difficult to do, it's extremely difficult to do, although it might seem to the casual observer, and I'm really not being funny here, to the casual observer it seems very easy, because all he has to do is reach up and hit his head. But that's not so. Any more than tap dancing, which looks so easy, is a difficult art if it's properly done. And yet it's a very human thing. And so here's the intermediate step. Now, this is related to Kopfspielen, but not really. It is and it isn't. It's the first example of, perhaps you could say, a mechanical contrivance being used in conjunction with the human body to produce a sound. Now, okay, will you please? Eins.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, now, if you will, please, I'll give you another example of Kopfspiele, but this time the emphasis would be placed on athleticism rather than specific musicality. How's this for a pompous you-know-what? All right, ein, zwei, hit it. That's another type.
It certainly is, and a rather abrupt ending, but there we had the musical virtuosity of Gene Shepherd, and we're rejoined by Eugene Bergman, the author of Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York, by the way. I'm here with Fred Hershkowitz, who's enjoying the interview.
I love it. I like the book. I like the author.
And we will be here. I just had contact with Mike Sargent of Night Shift. We'll be talking to Mike at around midnight. He will say hi to everyone. And we will continue here until 2 o'clock. Tony Short will be in at 2 o'clock for Person to Person. And then I'll be back with more Gene Shepherd at 4 o'clock on Mass Backwards.
Wow.
What a thrill, huh? And away we go. And where do we go from here? Eugene, any thoughts? I hear Farber used to do that all the time. Throw it over to you, Eugene.
Well, the interesting thing for me about Shepherd's music playing is they're all very quirky sorts of instruments, from his head itself to kazoo and jew's harp and nose flute. And in a sense, they're really strange, and many people would find them unpleasant, and they're certainly not things that you could, say, in tune, play any extended song. You can recognize the fact that the sound is going, the tone is going up and down as the music is, but it's not really in tune, so it sounds very, we could say, amateurish, except that Shepherd was extremely good at playing each of these. I'm sure he put a lot of effort into learning how to play them over the years, and he was really good at it, and he made it entertaining and fun.
And it does help to have the music playing in the background so you can recognize what it is he's playing.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. And it was one of those aspects of Shepherd that I think of as being part of his silly mood. You know, occasionally he would say that he was in a silly mood, and that's what it was. And it was fun to listen to Shepherd when he was being silly.
And, you know, most of the shows, at least from the 45-minute program era, from, what, 62 or so through the end of the show, 15 years, usually the first 15 minutes would be rather loose before he got down to the theme of the program and got either more serious or at least more into the storytelling mode. And very often there would be some musical business like that at the top of the program before the 15-minute commercial break. Speaking of which, if you'd like to pledge to WBAI, we are offering Eugene's book, Excelsior, You Fathead. Apparently, we can now offer that by itself for $100 with your subscription to WBAI, but you'll want to get the companion CD, which they have listed for $65 back there. But if you get it with the book, autographed book, by the way, you can get that for a pledge of $150 cheap. As we used to say over at Mad Magazine, 212-209-2950, because this is an emergency summer fun drive for WBAI the first day. Our goal, we've got to make close to $30,000 a day. And this show, hopefully, will put us closer to that mark, but we've got to do better. You out there have got to do better. We'll be with you, as I say, until 2 and then return at 4. So I get to take a break and finally have breakfast at some point this evening. Now let's turn to Shepard's, I don't know what, books, television, or movies, or even his stage plays. He had quite a show business career, actually, early on in New York. He was in a number of reviews that were, well, I guess like little off-Broadway things that not a lot of people knew about or went to. So what about his theater aspirations to begin?
Well, would you like me to comment on that?
Yes.
One of the first, if not the first, was something called Look Charlie, which Shepard actually... basically created all by himself. That is, he got some of his friends together and produced it. When I say friends, I mean people such as the cartoonist and soon-to-be playwright Herb Gardner, the cartoonist and one day to be also the poet of many children's books, Shel Silverstein, the actress who was one day to be Shepard's wife for 6 or 7 years, Lois Nettleton, and Shepard himself and a few band instruments. And they did some sort of little review with a variety of things such as juggling and, I guess, singing in Dixieland and... who knows what else? We really don't know exactly what else went into this thing, but it was, a very energetic and amusing little put-together piece that didn't go through too many performances on the Lower East Side, but must have been a lot of fun to see. And then he...
I know he played Mephistopheles in something once.
Yes,
he talks about it often on the radio.
Well, that was... I'm trying to quickly...
Of course, I don't recall the title of it either, but I know he often refers to...
Yes, it had to do with the moon, and I'm quickly trying to find it in my book as I'm talking. You can probably tell by the nature of... what I'm saying, that I'm searching frantically, and
of course, I have the wrong web. I'm looking at the BAI webpage instead of the Flick Lives webpage.
Here it is, Banquet for the Moon, done in 1961. But that, of course, is something that Shepard did not write. That's something that he simply played a part in a play that someone else created. He did a number of plays around 1960-61, and according to one of his close friends, he really felt that he could go into theater as a major career move, and he felt that he was quite a good actor. He was, as you said before, in a couple of reviews, such as Leonard Sillman's New Faces of 1962, in which apparently he wrote his own skits as part of that whole production.
I wonder how he found the time to do all of that, which must involve a lot of rehearsal, not to mention the performances, as well as doing the daily radio show. There must have been
a lot
to do.
My feeling is, from looking at the chronology of his creative career, which I put together in somewhat of a chart, the period from the, say, the mid to late 50s into the very early 60s, he was just all over the place in every medium you could think of, in every field of creative work that you can think of. He even did what's called a fumetti, that is a story done by using photographs and then having a little balloon captions.
Comic strip style in photographs.
Right.
And what was that, Grump magazine? I know
that was Help magazine. And the editor or whoever wrote the front matter in the beginning of the magazine commented that he seemed to be ubiquitous on the New York scene at that period. And indeed, he sure did. He was emceeing jazz concerts.
And writing articles in jazz magazines in the 50s. But
yes.
What's the earliest evidence of short stories, though, in fiction that you know of?
Well, Shel Silverstein, according to Hugh Hefner, Shel Silverstein is the one who got Shepard to talk into a recording device, a tape machine, and speak his stories so that they could then be transcribed and edited and submitted to Playboy. So it's my impression that the earliest fiction that he did was indeed the Playboy stories.
And this grew directly, you saying, that out of the radio stories?
Yes, I think everyone is aware that the Playboy stories are, to a great extent, stories that he told on the air. And if Hugh Hefner's memory is correct, and as he heard the tale from Shel Silverstein, it was Shel's getting Shepard to talk these stories into a microphone connected to a tape recorder that led to Shepard then writing fiction, short fiction, and publishing it.
And I guess the forays into television came mostly after his radio career was over.
Well,
he had done some while he was still on the radio. The documentary series Gene Shepard's America, the first volume, first edition, was while he was still on the air. But the branching out and moving on to another medium, I think, may have been necessitated by his losing the radio show in 1977.
Probably. Of course, the Shepherd's Pie series that he did for New Jersey Public Television was after radio. He had done some earlier television work, such as something called Rear Bumper in Philadelphia before he even came to New York. And then, of course, he was a guest on a variety of programs, such as Steve Allen and The Tonight Show, et cetera, where he got to do little bits and pieces. But his major creative work, I would say, would be Rear Bumper, in Philadelphia, and then the Gene Shepherd's America and Shepherd's Pie. Now, the other television work he did, the three big 90-minute stories, fictional stories.
American Playhouse on
right. They're
PBS.
Right. They're all based on the short stories. So as good as they are, they're not original creative work. This creative work, obviously, in transforming the written stories into a teleplay and getting that produced, but it's not exactly the same as creating the work originally for a medium.
Eugene, can you hear me? This is Fred. I'm working with Max tonight.
Yes.
When he appeared on Steve Allen and he told the story, as you said, was it in the form of standing up at a microphone like a stand-up comic? Did he sit down and tell it to Steve? What did it look like when he told the story on the Steve Allen show?
Well, I have not seen any of those. However, what I have seen of his little snips of him being on television in those early days and telling a story is, unfortunately, I think he wasn't using the television medium very well, because to just look at the camera and tell a story such as he did on the radio is not exactly appropriate and appreciated by a very big television audience.
Right. You're sitting down when you do that. That's when all of us who do radio sit down. But I wonder if you ever did things standing up at a microphone.
Oh, well, of course. The example we can point to is the Limelight shows and all of his concert appearances at Carnegie Hall, for example, where he... You know, he turned into a different performer. On the radio, he was intimate.
He had to use his body, too.
Yeah, well, you know, there is one concert that was recorded for New Jersey Public Television from the Clinton Museum, and it's basically a 75-minute show, and he paces around the stage, and he gesticulates, and, you know, he's a different performer in front of an audience. He likes to incite them. You know, get them going, make them cheer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gets them in on his little conspiracy or his giant orgy. He's always trying to incite an orgy at the Limelight.
Mm-hmm.
So he is quite a different performer, as you know, and we have some evidence of that from this one television show. Now, on his other television show that Gene mentioned was called Shepherd's Pie, and it basically combined elements. There was sometimes a little documentary film, like here's the junkyard and here's what goes on in the junkyard, and he narrates it, but the rest of it is like a very low budget.
It's on PBS
public access. Well, it was on the New Jersey network, on Eastern Seaboard network, and he would come out. He had a practically bare stage with a stool and half of a curtain in the background and some ladders. You know, it was like almost like your backstage. And he'd come out and sit on the stool and talk to the camera and insult the guys working on the crew. Do demonstrations, like one was he did taste tests of different hamburgers from, you know, different...
That was the Shea Junke.
That's right.
I believe.
And even it, and his wife, I don't know, was Lee... I guess Lee Brown by that time was his wife, his producer. And she even participates as well, gives him a little peck on the cheek at one point. Well, hey, look, the tally has jumped up. Not terrific, but, you know...
It's wonderful. We have some names of people.
We do, actually. We have a few people. We only know of two, but they are Matthew Abuelo of Port Washington, Long Island, I guess, and out in Brooklyn, Pablo Acosta are two of the people who have joined us this evening. We urge other listeners to join us as well.
Are they getting the Gene Shepherd packages or the book by your guest?
One is just a good old listener sponsor, and we need more of those for as little as $25.
Please give us a ring at 212-209-2950 as we interview the author of...
But Pablo... He wants it all. He says, I haven't heard Gene Shepherd in 40 years.
Wow.
He's getting the book, he's getting the CD, and he's getting whatever he wants to choose. He's getting 100 hours of, you know, other radio programming, whether it be Gene Shepherd or the old-time radio stuff. He can have his pick, and that's one of the things we're offering
tonight. 212-209-2950. Tonight, our Gene Shepherd night, if you'd like... the book and the tapes, the CDs, Gene Shepherd's rich storytelling and the biography, 212-209-2950.
Book by itself, autographed, $100. Book and CD companion, $150. And if you want Gene Shepherd radio broadcasts in a variety of formats, you ask for the list. That's a separate premium, and you get to choose from that list any two items for a $75 pledge and any four items for a $125 pledge. All of these pledges make you listener sponsors of the radio station. And if you'd like to see those lists of the Gene Shepherd material that's available, you can head on over to flicklives.com. And right near the top, it says, Listen to Shep Again. Max Schmid presents Gene Shep. Wow, look at that. I'm on a website. And if you click on that, it will take you right to a place. So if you don't want to even call, you can pledge online. And it links to all of the various levels of fundraising. And say there, if you go over, it says, Select any two items from the list. And there's a little copy of the list there. You click on that, and it opens up all of the vast... the many, many varieties. We've got detective shows, comedy shows, historical shows, and lots of Gene Shepherd, because this list is actually started out as a Golden Age of Radio list. That's another little program I do here Sunday nights, 7 to 9, and Gene Shepherd is also included there. So look it over and then decide to give us a call, 212-209-2950. Pledge what you can, but do support WBAI because we're at a critical juncture. We need to raise this money just to get us through till the next fund drive in September or October. And hopefully with as minimal impact on the paid staff here as possible to help us survive. Now, Eugene, I know you're down not exactly on business in Florida, but I expect you have some busy times ahead.
Yes.
So I don't want to keep you up all night long.
Right. We have to get up very early each morning to get my son to a baseball camp with a really highly competitive group of guys being taught by some highly skilled coaches. My son's 14 years old, and he's
a future
baseball star.
Or Met.
he hopes to someday be on the Yankees.
Ah, okay.
And I think he has a shot at it.
Well, there you go. Well, good luck to him. And thanks for being with us tonight. Any parting thoughts you'd like to let the audience know about?
Well, I'm constantly getting little additional pieces of information as we all are finding more things out about Shepherd's works in many fields. I'm hoping that as more people read my book and continue to listen to your program and look at the websites and so on, that more and more people will say, hey, in the attic, gee, I've got some tapes, or I've got a piece of such and such Shepherd material that I'll bet they'd be interested in. And, you know, this stuff keeps coming in, and I'm looking forward to eventually getting some of those really early shows where he perpetrated the great book hoax about I Libertine, and where he got fired for doing a commercial for a soap. And, you know, there's all kinds of exciting stuff out there that we're still hoping to find out about. And
that's true. There's very little from the 50s outside of what you yourself recorded.
Well, surely I'm not the only one.
Well, but you're the only one we know about so far.
Right.
There's a poster of Gene Shepherd emceeing Billie Holiday. It looked like the last year of her life, a concert that she was doing. Am I right? That's in the book. I just kept looking at that. That was very, very haunting for me to see that.
I think it's extraordinary how important Shepherd was in the New York jazz scene, and that poster showing Shepherd as the narrator for the concert starring Billie Holiday, the Modern Jazz Quartet, Charles Mingus Quintet, et cetera, et cetera, in 1957, just shows what an important part of the jazz scene he was.
Did he ever talk about listening to or being inspired by Lord Buckley at all?
Not that I know of. Now, I interviewed the author of the major biography of Lord Buckley called Dig Infinity, and he's not aware of them having much connection. However, other people I've talked to said that, oh yes, they enjoyed each other's work. Lord Buckley was a rather strange jazz-like, I don't know whether to call him a humorist or storyteller or exactly what he was, but he was a weird, quirky, underground type guy who fascinating stuff in the 50s.
His voice became an instrument when he told the story. And I guess, I'm waiting all night this. Did Gene Shepherd and Lenny Bruce ever talk to each other? I mean, anything go on between them at all?
It's my understanding that they knew each other and appreciated, at least Shepherd sometimes said he seemed to appreciate Lenny Bruce's work, and at other times...
like in the Lenny Bruce documentary.
He had some reservations over what Bruce was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But he did He did speak at the tribute.
Yes, but it's interesting if you listen to that Gene Shepherd portion of the tribute. To me, Shepherd seems to be mostly talking about himself and only peripherally bringing Lenny Bruce in into the mix.
Okay, well, we did have a phone call there, but fortunately they've gone away. And
we're going to have to pitch a little bit now.
I think we're going to thank you at this point and say good evening. And get some rest. I know athletes need their rest, and their dads as well.
Right. Well, I'm glad I managed to make the connection with you this evening, and I always enjoy talking about Shepherd, and good luck on your pledge drive.
Well, thank you, and hopefully we'll give away, so to speak, so many books you'll have to come down and sign some more.
I'd be delighted.
Sign mine. Thank you.
Right.
Thanks a lot. Good night, and thanks for writing the book.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Night. Eugene Bergman.
He has to sign my book. I went out and got one. 212. Ladies and gentlemen, it's 11:45. You just heard, a really great interview. Max, that was wonderful with Eugene Bergman, the author of Excelsior. You fathead. What's the complete title?
The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd.